Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about your estate planning for your children. And to lead us in that discussion is Mark Levine, attorney at law, partner, handler in Levine, Bethesda, Maryland, but will answer questions from around the world and certainly the country. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Bob.
And John Elliott, retired Fed, retired seminar presenter, but still a federal benefit strategist and co-host of the show often. And good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
So this should be good. We're going to talk about this, your estate planning. Now, this is the listener for your children. I guess you could do it for other children, but let's stick with their children, okay?
But most people are more focused on their own kids than my kids. But if anyone's interested in doing estate planning for my kids, we'll talk about that too.
That's right. And we'll give out the phone number and the email and not the distant future. So hang on till then. All right. Why do estate planning for children? And I would imagine this is very delicate, so this is probably going to take all the show to talk about, well, what ifs. But let's do the basics.
I think having kids is the reason a lot of people start their estate planning. One of the questions I get all the time is, do I need to do estate planning? When should I start doing estate planning? What's the right time? How much money do I need before I do estate planning? Things like that. And really, there are a lot of good answers to that if you never have kids. But if you have children, you really need to have an estate plan. You need to have something that sets up what happens to your stuff, what happens to your kids, how do people that you choose use your assets to take care of your children to make sure they stay on the path that you would want them to be on. So once you have kids, you really have to do estate planning. It's like getting life insurance for them, or if you have a car, getting car insurance. If you have a house, having homeowners insurance. If you have children, estate planning is something you really need to do. It's part of that responsibility.
All right. Now, would you run the estate planning through if there is a spouse or a significant other? I mean, are they kind of the, excuse the sports analogy, the quarterback of the estate here? Are they the ones pulling the trigger, or do trusts get set up directly to the children so that the spouse or the significant other doesn't have any control?
So almost always when we're talking about a situation where it's the same spouse with the same children, not blended families or things like that, it's almost always going to be at the second death that we're really focused on this stuff. We may create trusts at the first death for the surviving spouse to make sure the money gets through to the children. But ultimately, when we're talking about these trusts and certainly guardianship issues, we're almost always talking about the second death. So mom and dad are both gone. What happens next? So the spouse is usually there isn't a trust for my children if I die, if my wife is still alive. It's usually at that second death that we're creating a trust that's just for them. They may be ancillary beneficiaries of a trust for my wife. They may be beneficiaries of some other things. Possibly, but almost always it's going to be spouse first, then kids in a situation where it's the same spouse with the same children.
Do you ever get clients where they say, okay, I want to provide for my children, but in the case of a death of my spouse or a divorce, how can I protect their assets from being channeled off somewhere else upon that person's death, or worse yet, the remarriage. I won't say worse yet, but it would be the remarriage. There's a lot of animosity there.
We get a lot of people, and this sort of is the first spouse planning rather than the sort of children planning, but I get a lot of clients who say to me, look, if I die tomorrow and my spouse lived for the next 50 years, uses everything I left them, I'm okay with that. That's what I signed up for. But if I die tomorrow and my spouse lives, you know, four more years and dies, I don't want my money going to their new spouse, to new children, especially when you're dealing with younger parents who have little kids. The likelihood is if that they passed away, their spouse would remarry. And they want to make sure that some of their assets are going to either be used by the spouse for the spouse or their joint children, or go to the joint children, not go to any subsequent children or other family members or subsequent spouses. And that's really the heart of the planning that we do for the first death. What if I die? How do I take care of my spouse and my children? As opposed to saying, okay, what if we're both dead? How do we do a trust or an estate plan that focuses on those minor children?
Let's say this is a common situation, of course. Your spouse dies or get divorced or something. But let's say your spouse dies and you remarry. And it's the so-called, as Bob brought up, a blended family. You want your assets to go directly to your kids. Do not pass go. Do you need a prenup in that case?
Well, a prenup is always the best solution in those situations, because a prenup will override joint property, will override the spouse's right to take a statutory share election, it will override the rights of subsequent spouses, and it will override the spouse changing their mind. So a prenup is always the best answer when you're entering into that subsequent relationship to deal with those issues. It's not the answer that a lot of people want to deal with, because they feel like they're planning for a marriage to fail with a prenup. And really, I don't know if your marriage is going to fail, but I know you're going to die. And I know that a prenup deals as much with death as it does with divorce and separation. So right. You can do prenups that don't mention the word divorce, don't mention the word separation. They just deal with, I have kids, you have kids, I have stuff, you have stuff, we're going to have stuff together. How do we deal with this at the first death? How do we deal with it at the second death?
My follow-up then would be, let's say you, in that situation, you don't get a prenup, but you already have an existing will where your children would inherit, you say a trust, say, is there, would that will then be solid and where the kids you would get them?
No,
because different states have different division of property rules.
Right. Again, in this first death situation, we're dealing with the spouse, and the spouse has rights, and a spouse has elects what they call a spousal election to take against the will. So if you leave all your money to the kids in your will and you leave nothing to your spouse will have a right, depending on the state, depending on the situation, to take part of that away from your children.
Yeah, so you definitely need a prenup. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and the folks listening need a phone number, 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. It's April 30th, 2012. It's almost 10:15. We'll be on for another, 55 minutes. So please give us a call. If you're listening other than this time, you can certainly email us at your benefit at nitpinc.com. For your benefit at nitpinc.com. NITP is the company that provides this show, as well as pre-retirement, mid-career, financial planning seminars, mid-career seminars, etc. Anyway, let's get back to Mark's zero focus now. We've got deep quick, didn't we? Let's get back to the basics. What do I look for then to provide for a minor child, and when do I do that? Do I do that as soon as they're born? Do I do that after I've got a certain net worth? How do you deal with the youngest client coming in, and then we'll maybe go to the mid-career, and then we'll go to the pre-retirement?
Sure. I think sometimes I am the first person outside the family to know someone's pregnant. They'll come in and say, we need to do estate planning, and I will often ask, well, what brought you? Or I'll say, do we want to deal with the future of you all having children or just deal with each other? And that's when they'll say, well, we're expecting and something like that. So from the moment you know, and I often have clients that come in the planning stages, we know we're going to have kids in the next couple of years. We want an estate plan in place that will take care of it. So if we become pregnant, this isn't something we have to worry about. This is, you know, done already. So basically, from the time you're planning children, and certainly from the time that you have children, this is something that you want to focus on. In terms of the net worth, I think that people sometimes focus on the wrong thing. They focus on what I call my estate I could buy a car with, you know, and they look at that and they say, well, we don't have any money, because if I need to go and buy a car, I don't have enough money to write a check for a car. I don't really need to do planning for it. But that isn't what we do planning for. We do planning for your life insurance, the equity in your home, your retirement accounts, all of those assets that are going to exist at your death. And those are typically much, much larger than the funds you have available to go buy a car. So when you're looking at, do I need to do planning, look at those numbers. And oftentimes the life insurance number is what's going to drive the estate planning. Young people sometimes have a bigger net worth than older people because they have these life insurance policies. When they have a kid and the kid is just born, they get a 20 or 30 year life insurance policy. They'll get an amount of money that may be 500 or a million or more in terms of dollars. And suddenly there's a very significant estate if they're both gone, even though there ain't a lot there right now when they're both around. So I think from that very first moment when you're looking at that, because the other thing you should be looking at when you're planning to have kids is life insurance and making sure that there's money there to take care of the kids if something happens to you.
So it would be set up then, it would go into a trust, and the trust would provide for the basic necessities of the child?
So there's a couple of different things we're looking at with this trust. The first thing we're looking at is absolutely the basic necessities: health, education, maintenance, and support. Those are sort of the foundation of the trust. And you give the trustee, typically when you're dealing with young children, a lot of flexibility. You know your trustee much better than you know your children, chances are. So you're going to give this trustee a lot of flexibility in how they're going to deal with your children for your children's health, education, maintenance, and support. So from 0 to 18, those things are taken care of out of the trust. And you may give guidance on some other specific issues that are of concern to you while they're minors. But for the most part, it's going to be the guardians and the trustees working out together, and they may very well be the same person, what it is these children need and using the money for those things. I think the more difficult thing for parents come when we start talking about children as adults. And that may be easy to do when you're talking about a 20-year-old. I will tell you it's very hard to do when I'm dealing with my 6-year-old. Imagining what her issues will be, imagining what she's going to be like at 18 versus 6 is difficult. And I assume, and what I try and get clients to focus on, is assuming the worst, not the best. I had a client come into me and say, I want my kids to get everything when they turn 18 years old. His kids were, I think, 2, 4, and 6 at the time. I said, well, 18-year-olds make very, very bad decisions with money. Sometimes they make bad decisions in destructive ways. Sometimes they make bad decisions in ways they think are constructive. They help their friends. They give money to charity. But they're not quite cynical enough to understand that you can't solve people's problems with money, and you need to take care of yourself so you can take care of other people. I said all this to this guy. He goes, well, that's not going to matter because I'm going to raise my kids right. I'm going to raise them so that at 18, they know how to handle this money. And what I wanted to say in my head was, is it okay if I pay you, if I charge you twice as much 5 years from now when you come in here wanting to change this trust? When you see your 11-year-old and your 9-year-old and your 7-year-old and realize it doesn't matter how much you think you're going to teach them, who they're going to be is to some extent out of your control.
Do you try to define that control, or do you try to pick a trustee that has an iron will but a good head?
So I think the most important characteristics for trustees are trust and common sense. And I think when you're talking about trustees for children, I think it's important when you're dealing with young children to look carefully at the guardians. I think ideally your guardians are going to be the people who are also at least a co-trustee of the trust. And my reasoning, a lot of people say to me, well, there's too much of a conflict of interest, too many gray areas there. And that's true. There are. And that's where the common sense comes in. But the other part of that is the person that you're giving your 6-year-old to, your 9-year-old to, is a person who you want to have the moral guidance over them. You trust their sense of right and wrong and what's important, and you want them to be guiding your child. But honestly, when your kid turns 18, it's the person with money that they have to listen to. It's the person with the money that they have to focus on if they want the things that they want. If you're alive, that person is you, and they're going to try and figure out, not quite as cynically as this perhaps, but what are the things that they do that gets them the things that they want. And so if your guardian is the person that you want to have this moral compass, why would you want that moral compass to end at 18? Why would you want their power to end at 18? So I think it's important, especially with young kids, to really look carefully. Is my guardian an appropriate person to also be the trustee? And if so, I think that's a good idea. As you get to more money, as you get to more complicated issues, sometimes we're going to add a co-trustee. We may add another family member. We may add a financial institution. If there are really significant conflicts, or if your guardian is a person who, yes, you trust them with your kids, But no, you don't actually trust them with your money. And that's a thing that most people aren't able to say. Most people find it very hard to say to someone, yes, I trust you with my children, but no, I don't trust you with their money. But if you're in one of those situations, then you may look at outside trustees as well. I think it doesn't matter as much if the kid's 16. In other words, they are not going to look at the guardian as the person who is their moral compass. You've had 16 years with them. Hopefully you've got that foundation with them. But I think it's really important with young kids.
All righty. If the funds are, let's say, modest to less, do you have provisions in there as to what we would educate them through high school, educate them through junior college, or after a while there's no money to pay if they wanted to go to maybe an expensive school?
I think that for education, we try and define it broadly. In other words, include as necessary, you know, private high school if you've got a kid with needs who is used to going to a private school. You want that to continue. In addition to education, I mean, in education, we always try and include college. We include graduate school, but we also include vocational education. In other words, your kid may not be a kid who goes to college, but they may go somewhere to get training. They may go somewhere to be able to do whatever it is that they want to do, and we want education to include those things as well. So not just college and grad school, but again, if there's no money, there's no money. Part of what your trustee is doing is managing that money and using it as efficiently as possible. So if there's a limited amount of resources, just like in your own life, you would say to your kid, listen, you know, you've gotten into a lot of great schools, but the truth is I can afford to help you go to the state school. I can't do anything with these other schools, and you're going to have to make some choices or find other money if you're going to be able to, if you want to go to these other schools. The trustee is going to do the same thing. The trustee is going to say, these are the funds. You might have gotten into all these great schools, and if we had the money, we'd pay for whichever one you wanted to go to. But this is the money we have, and it's only going to last a certain amount of time. And as the child gets older, you'll have more interaction with that child in terms of what's here to use, especially if there's limited resources.
Years ago, I was involved as the accountant, not as the trustee. And it was an unfortunate situation. The parents passed, and the one child lived, but was severely damaged. And the trustees that got a hold of the money decided that there should be a lot nicer house for this child to live in, and there should be a swimming pool, and there should be certain types of cars. And I said, and there'll be one less accountant involved with this, because I just, it was going quicker. There was a lot of money there, but it was going quicker than what could, they would need this money for the rest of the child's life.
Yeah, I think a trustee has a responsibility. A trustee has a responsibility to invest the money and use it wisely and sort of, you know, stay to the path that they think is either set out in the documents clearly or that they know what the parents want. In other words, you know, the kid comes and says, I want a car. You hope the trustee says, well, there's some nice, you know, models here that you can get. So when the kid says, well, I'd really like that Ferrari, the trustee is going to say, well, yes, they're both cars, but one of them's appropriate and one of them's not. And we'll help you with the appropriate one. We're not going to help you with the other one. And that gets to the next part of the trust. In other words, the under 18 part of the trust in some ways is easy. You take care of the kid. You put a roof over their head. You clothe them. You feed them. You educate them. When they're adults, it becomes trickier because with adult abilities also come adult problems and uncertainties. And so when is it that this trust money is going to go from being controlled 100% by this trustee to being controlled 100% by this child? And what's the process for getting from point A to point B? Because 18 is an adult, but we don't want our 18-year-olds being in control of the money. So when do they get control? And that, I think, is the second part of the trust. And that part of the trust, we really want to stress, especially, again, when the kids are young, flexibility. We don't know who our kids are going to be. We don't know what they're going to need. We don't know what's going to be appropriate for them. And so we're giving these judgments to our trustees to say, you're going to be the one with the information. We want you to be the one who makes decisions, but here's guidelines. So at least for me, when I created the trust for my children and when I talk to clients, I do think it's important to give a guideline to say, look, if everything is basically appropriate, here's how I'd like you to go down this path, to take this trust, to give the money. And so the kid doesn't look at the trust as something that they're never going to get or resent it or think that, you know, it's always going to be kept from them because I think that creates problems also. So I think if there's a path, that's helpful. And so when we look at that path, we start sort of with the end point. When's the trust going to end? If this child is basically appropriate, when are they going to have control of all of their money? And I think the younger the kid is, the later that age is going to be. So for my six-year-old, I have a trust that goes till she's 40. I hope when I'm 20, when she's 20, I'm going to look at that and say, that's ridiculous. This is a good kid. She makes good decisions. I'm not ready for her to inherit money tomorrow. But if something happened to me tomorrow, I think she could handle it by 30. So I'm going to change my trust. I hope when she's 25, I'm going to look at her and say, she's a great kid. If she got the money tomorrow, she'd do better with it than I'm doing with it now. She could have it. And I'll change the trust to say, you know, if I die tomorrow, she gets that money at 25. But right now, I want that age far out. I'd rather she get the money 5 years too late than 5 years too early. So I have that outside age. But at the same time, I want there to be money going to her. I want her to start managing her own money, start being able to deal with things herself. So I'll say give, you know, 5% at 22, 10% at 25, 25% at 30, at 35, the rest at 40, so that over a period of time, not only is she managing it more herself, but she's making her own mistakes. You know, if you get $50,000 at 22 and it's gone in a month, hopefully when you get that next check, you have a little more understanding of how quickly money disappears and how quickly you can spend it and how quickly it's gone. And so I want her to have that experience. I want her to fail, but I'd like her to fail a little. I mean, sure, it'd be great if she does everything perfectly the first time out, but I don't assume that's what's going to happen. So I have this whole guideline, this range. At the same time, I never want my kids to not be able to get a house because the trust, you know, they have to wait 5 more years to get that next check. So we have provisions that say, I'd like my trustee, if they're appropriate people, to help my kids buy a house, do a down payment on a house, start an appropriate business. If they have kids of their own, I want them to help them with their kids, pay for preschool, pay for things that are necessary for their children, help them out. And I have 3 daughters, so I have a provision about paying for weddings for my children, 1 wedding for each of my daughters. They can deal with the second wedding themselves. Hopefully there wouldn't be one, but and I also understand that my kids may exceed my expectations. And so if my daughter is a hedge fund manager at 27, I hope my trustee, who in my case is my sister, will give her everything at 27. She can handle the money. She's dealing with it appropriately. She doesn't need someone else. She doesn't need her aunt in charge of her money. At the same time, if my daughter's making skeevy boyfriend choices at 34, I hope my sister's going to say, you know what? You're not showing good judgment. There are people in your life who aren't appropriate. We're going to stick to the schedule. You're not going to get the money early. And if there's drugs or alcohol, if there are spousal issues, boyfriend, girlfriend issues, mental issues, right now my sister has the power to extend that trust even further because I don't know what the situation will be. As my kids get older, I'm going to take that away. I'm going to take away that flexibility my sister has because I know my kids better. I don't need to say, you know what, you can hold it past 40 because I'm going to have a much better idea, I hope, of who they are.
Now, how do your clients buy into that mindset?
The younger the kids are, the more the clients buy into it, I think. And that's because we don't know who they are. I think initially, when I say the age 40, the parents are like, wow, that's old. And I don't know about that. And gosh, when I was 30, I could handle the money. And what I try and get clients to do is realize, look, you're taking all of this and applying it to who you were. But you have both your parents. You didn't lose them at 16 or lose them at 10. You don't know what their situation is going to be. Like I said, I'd rather my kids get the money 5 years too late than 5 years too early. I never want my kids to have enough money to do nothing, to say, I don't have to get up tomorrow. I don't have to get a job. I don't have to do this. I don't have to do that. I want them to have to work. I want things to be hard occasionally. I think that's okay. But at the same time, I don't want it trapped. I mean, I've seen so many trusts for kids where the trust says you get 10% at 30 and you get 10% at 40 and you get the rest when you turn 65. And the trusts are set up in a way that there is no flexibility. You know, when the trustee comes in and says, I'd like to give my niece more money, and I look at the trust and I say, you can't. You know, you can maybe give a little more here, a little more there. You can tweak the investments to throw off more income, but you can't write a check to the principal because the trust doesn't say you can. And I never want that. I want there to be that flexibility.
What if there's more than one child, but all children are not created equal, and one might have an issue? but the other one is the hedge fund manager. How do you deal with animosity? How do you deal with potentially alienating the two?
I think it depends on the issue to some extent. So if, as your kids are growing up, it's apparent that one of them has a mental issue, a physical issue, an emotional issue, the other kids are going to grow up with that reality. And the fact that more resources are being sent towards that child is probably going to be less bothersome to them because that's been their experience their whole life. They have more needs and they're getting more resources. Still may create problems. I think it's the kids as they get older and the kid who just doesn't achieve. And maybe there's some marginal drug or alcohol issues or some marginal mental issues, but nothing that is a diagnosable thing or a debilitating thing. They just don't want to work as much or they aren't as successful. And the parent is the one who comes in and says, listen, my other two kids are fine. He's a doctor. She's a lawyer. This one can't hold a job. So I want to leave all of my assets or 50% to them and 25% to them or this amount. And typically we get into other issues because it is not uncommon for that child to be living with the parents. It's not uncommon for that child to already be dependent on the parents if they are the child that they want to disproportionately benefit with their estate planning. So you already have a lot of these issues coming out. It depends on the family. Some families, again, the doctor and the lawyer are fine. They're okay with the disproportionate distribution at mom and dad's death. They're expecting it, and whatever they get, they're surprised by sometimes. But there's lots of cases where they're not. And so how do you deal with that? Ultimately, it's the parents' decision. The parents, at the end of the day, get to decide where their money goes. No child has a right to inherit equally or at all. But we look at things like how do we make it seem as fair as possible. So one of the things that we do is what I call, and ultimately I have to come up with a better name for this, but a slush trust, where if there are three children, one of whom has issues, we will split things four ways, a quarter for each of them, and 25% in a trust. And usually the child who has needs, their share is also going to be in a trust. So we have these two trusts that are set up. Doctor gets his 25%, lawyer gets her 25% outright, but the child with more needs gets their 25% in a trust, and this other 25% is sort of left hanging there. And it's there in case the child needs it, in case they end up having those greater disproportionate needs that mom and dad fear that they'll have. I won't say that, you know, doctor child and lawyer child are thrilled with this arrangement always, but at least they understand that ultimately those shares may come back into their family, that it's only going to be used if necessary, that there are usually a lot more controls over how that money's used. So instead of 50% going outright to the black sheep, the 25% goes to doctor, 25% goes to lawyer, and the 50% at least is being held in trust with some restrictions, with someone overlooking how that's going to be done.
Okay, I have been put into the position and guard it now as being trustee for some trust and had exactly that where the two that were, if you will, normal and the one that wasn't just, you know, would bear their venom to me about, you know, mom and dad treated the, and I said, what do you want me to do? This is my job. I have to execute my job. Otherwise, somebody else could sue me. I'm going to do this and I'm going to be as fair as I can, but I can't violate the rules. So when looking at a trustee, you don't really want an iceberg, but you want somebody that can stand up and potentially push back what they know is coming.
Yeah, I think, again, a trustee, trust, common sense are really, really important. Common sense is a wildly underrated value, I think, when it comes to picking professionals and trustees and people, fiduciaries and people like that. I think often people will come into me and say, well, I'm going to have, you know, lawyer sister be the trustee for the brother who we're not, you know, we're worried about. And what I'll ask is, number one, can she do it? Is it something from her disposition that she's able to do? And is she going to have to choose at some point between being a sister or a trustee? Because as a sister, if she doesn't give the money that brother wants, he's going to cut her off. He's going to blame her. It's going to destroy their relationship as siblings. As a trustee, if she wants to avoid losing her relationship as a sibling, she's going to have to bend as a trustee. And so very often that's where you end up with one of two things, either a third-party trustee or a co-trustee, where you have sister being a co-trustee with someone she can blame. So if she's co-trustee with you, she can say, you know, I would give you the money. But Bob won't, you know, he's inflexible. He won't do it. So he's the bad guy. I would do it, but he's the bad guy. And so you become a professional bad guy. You're the guy who won't bend, who will only do it. And you're doing that to save the relationship of the sister and brother.
And probably the toughest one I ever had, it was two children. And the one had issues, the other one did not. But the estate had assets in it. It wasn't all cash. There was stuff. And then they were to agree upon the stuff. And it was just awful. And finally, the one that was, if you will, normal just said, what do you want? Give me the paper. Because the other one wore him down. And it was rough to be in the same room.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, when you're dealing with adult children, you really want to – it's really a very different thing. You don't have the unknowns. And as a parent and as the professional talking to the parent, we spend a lot of time talking about who your kids are and how they get along and what's actually going to happen. And you have the luxury of that when you're dealing with adult children. You don't have the luxury of that when you're dealing with minor kids. You don't know who they are and how they're going to get along and things like that. So, again, when we're dealing with the young kids, we usually say the trustee is going to decide with the tangible personal property, with the stuff, who gets what. Unless mom and dad really care that the jewelry goes to the daughter and the tools go to the son, then we'll put that in. But we are normally going to offload that responsibility to the adult trustee when we're dealing with minor children. With adult kids, it's the parents' responsibility to say, these are who my kids are. This is what they're likely to act on and to deal with that more appropriately.
Tell you what I did. I'm sure you've run across this, but maybe some of the listening audience hasn't. I told the one, you stay in the room, told the other one, would you please go outside the building? And I said, do you know what's being done to you? Yeah. I said, your turn. You go outside the building, bring the other one in. I said, do you know what you're doing to the other one? Yeah. And I knew where I was going. I was going nowhere until one gave and one did. But I did the best I could, but I had to bring it to some resolution.
Ultimately, that's the parent's responsibility. That's the parent's fault. It's not your fault. You weren't given the tools to deal with that appropriately. And that's what estate planning is. It's very, very easy to say, I'm giving power to this person, or I am giving the choice of assets to that person. What's very, very hard is what happens next. How do you figure out how this is actually going to work in real life? And that's where an estate planning attorney comes into it. That's where someone who's done this 100 times, not just on the planning end, but actually once someone dies, how you deal with it and what the options are. So I think that's really where the, not art, but the what we do, the creativity and dealing with clients and each family being different, that's where that comes in. Because ultimately, the parents and the advisor failed to come up with a plan that would work for that particular family.
Are you ever put in the position to say, Mark, what would you do? And you met them years ago. Maybe these are the people that hadn't had children yet but wanted to provide for it because they had too many other things going on when the children did come. And you go, Mark, what would you say? And then they come back later and say, you know, we've either done not as well as we thought, or we've done as well or better. Mark, what do we do now? Is this kind of an ongoing process where you'd be adjusting the wills and who gets what?
Hopefully. When kids are young, again, we're dealing all with the worst case scenarios and with options for the best case scenarios. As kids get older, we're dealing more with reality. These are who the kids are. These are what the assets are. We still want flexibility. We still want something where things can bend a little bit and the actuality of what happens when you die comes into play. But as kids get older, as the situation gets more and more concrete and real, the planning gets more precise. And so very often we'll do an estate plan, a trust for kids when the first kid's born, and the basics of that trust may not change for years. I mean, really, it shouldn't change until the kids are in their early 20s. And then from 20 to 30, we may change that trust two or three times as the children mature along the same path, along different paths. The reality of who they are and what their needs are changes. And then, generally after 30 or so, you know who your kids are. And you know that, yeah, they'll all be able to handle it, or some will and some won't, and some are going to have these needs and some won't. And again, you're going to sort of focus on that plan, and that plan may exist forever after that. I mean, maybe change as tax laws change and things like that, but the plan may stay relatively the same over that period of time. So I think there are those three periods in life where you're going to have three different plans, or in that middle period, you may have a number of different plans.
So this is not a one and done deal. And then I get the other that I'm sure you never hear. I don't want to go to the attorney because it's going to cost me money. And I'm sure you hear it. I don't want to go to the accountant. I don't want to go to the benefits advisor because it's going to cost me money. And I go, do you go to the doctor? Well, of course. And I said, does it cost you money? And they go, of course. And I go, and why do you go to the doctor? For well-being? Yes. And I said, this is the same thing.
Yeah, I think that we always tell clients, you're going to look at this again every 3 to 5 years. And I think most attorneys do this. We do this. We send out a letter to our clients saying, come back in for a checkup. I mean, exactly that. Come back in and let's see what's changed in your life. Let's see what's changed in your assets, in your kids, in the people that you've named to these different fiduciary roles, and figure out if that still makes sense. So we send those letters out every 3 years. Clients almost always ignore those letters. but ultimately, you know, in some time in that period, it reminds them as things change in their lives, oh, you know what? Mark said we should call him if things were changing, or he said 2 years ago we should come back in, or I'll send them another letter. And ultimately, they do come back in. And sometimes those meetings are very short. What's changed? Nothing. You still feel good about your people? Yeah. Okay. Well, let's look at any tax changes or law changes that may require some changes. But other than that, that's all there is to it. And sometimes there's big changes.
That's right. And you get those letters and they say, well, something's happened. More often than not, I think at the state level, because the federal level set so high currently.
Currently,
let's underline currently. But the state maybe isn't. And we can't just talk about the local three because we have people all over the country and outside the country listening. But if that state law changes, it may well be worth going in and adjusting. If the federal changes, we'll know that by, I'm sure, this time next year.
Well, yeah, hopefully. Maybe this time next year. Maybe not. I think it's important to remember throughout the country is that there are a number of different states that have a much lower estate tax threshold. And there are some states with a threshold as low as $1 million. There's one state that is, I think, $650,000, a state that's in the 800s. So where you live and where you have real estate, the estate tax laws may be much more of an issue to you. In our area, we have D.C. and Maryland, which have $1 million exemption, and Virginia, which has no state-level exemption at all. And again, for parents, there are different issues because in Maryland, you've got to do planning earlier at the first death to try and maximize the amount of money that's going to go to your kids at the second death. So the tax laws definitely do enter into it, the local ones much more so than the federal currently.
And, I mean, you have to keep up on this, which of course you do, but that must be almost a part-time job, just keeping up and going and reading and or going to seminars or webinars.
You know, the good news about doing the retirement seminars is that I keep the materials updated and I'm constantly updating the materials as things change or as the laws change. So there have been some small changes, for example, in Maryland probate. That are going to be effective in October that we just found out about, or the statutory power of attorney, or as Ohio's changing their estate tax law, for example. And those are things that on a regular basis I'm updating the materials. So I keep track of it for that reason, as well as the fact that I have clients coming in with all those issues.
That's a good point. On the tax side, I probably change it 4 times a year just because a ruling came out or something new came on. I'm sure John got it worse with the federal benefits section, although that's
that's
centrally
constant.
Done now by pretty much Tammy. But
yeah, it's the Congress has been mischievous over the years.
That's the nicest way I've ever heard someone say that.
And there are, and currently there are possibly many adverse consequences to retirement law coming. Maybe, maybe not, but.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I read that federal page every morning and it seems like there's something else they're talking about.
Never seems good though.
No, right now it's not good. In 2009, it was all good. We got the Roth TSP, which is finally being implemented. But a lot of positive changes in 2009, but the political landscape has changed since 2010 election, and now it's all bad.
Okay, so now I'm all confused. How do I get in touch with you, Mark?
We have a website, www.handlerlevine.com, HANDLERLEVINE.com. My email is Mark, M-A-R-C, at handlerlevine.com, HANDLERLEVINE.com. Our phone number, 301-961-6464, extension 3313.
Do that phone number again with the extension.
It's 301-961-6464, extension 3313.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Because it does change, and then you're also the referee, and also people need to address this sooner rather than later.
What I find is the biggest reason people don't come in other than pure procrastination is picking trustees and guardians. It's the biggest set of arguments that I get with clients. Sometimes the first time they're having the discussion about who the guardian will be is in my office. And as you can guess, it's a fascinating discussion sometimes, because what happens is everyone's assumptions are different, or they already know that the other one's not going to like what they want. And so what I tell clients is, who say to me, well, we don't know who our guardian's going to be, so we want to settle that first and then we'll come in. And what I remind clients is, you never want to let perfect get in the way of better. There is no perfect person to raise your kids other than you. There's no one who is ideal. You have to pick the best people who can do the job, and think about who's going to do it if you do nothing. If you don't do the planning, if you don't put someone's name down and create a trust for the kids and do all of that, who's going to step up? And it may be a person that you otherwise would not think is appropriate.
Are there court appointed? If nobody's been named, does the court then appoint somebody?
Sure. There's always going to be somebody appointed as the custodian of the children, as the guardian of the children, and as the person in charge of the money for the kids.
Okay. Now, how would the court do that? I mean, we could probably have four shows on that, but generally speaking, what do they look at first?
So the difference for guardianship between naming someone and not is that if you name someone, they are the person who's presumed to be appropriate. They're going to go into court and say, I've been named by the parents, and the court's going to be looking at, why aren't you appropriate? So, you know, were you, as it turns out, have, you know, financial issues or a drug problem or marital issues that the deceased parents weren't aware of? And someone comes up and says, listen, you know, Mark thought they'd be great, but what he didn't know was X, Y, and Z. And so the court is going to look always at the best interest of the child for that. If you don't name anyone, it becomes a contest. Who's better? And so you have an aunt on this side and an uncle on that side, dad's brother, mom's sister, who come in and fight over which one of them's better. And who should the court pick? And I'm better than them, and they're better, and I knew them better, and I'm more responsible. And it becomes a fight. And the person who makes the decision, and this is the way that our legal system is set up, the person who makes the decision is the person with the least amount of information. The judge always has the least amount of information to decide who the winner of any court decision should be, including who should your guardian be.
And who also wins, the one with the best attorney?
That may very well be. You know, the attorneys are certainly going to make money on that situation, and you're going to leave a lot of hard feelings. A lot of the things that people want to do when we're talking about guardianship, we don't just say, well, you're in charge of the kids. We're also going to say, number one, what's the line of succession? If not you, then who? But we're also going to talk about what's the relationship between your children and the other side of the family. So if my sister's the guardian for my kids, I've got a specific provision in there that says, it's a priority to us, including to the extent that you should spend money on it, to keep the relationship with the maternal side of the family. If my sister's the guardian, I want to make sure that my wife's parents are going to see our kids. And I want the trust to fly them there. And I want the trust to make sure to keep
you
up
can,
those
you
relationships.
Can do that.
Absolutely. Now, how enforceable that is, again, the guardian is always going to be looking at the best interests of the child, and are they safe with other people and things like that. But we want my in-laws to have a right, as much as we can create one, to have a relationship with my kids, even though they're with my sister rather than, for example, my wife's brother. We also can put in language about religious upbringing, things like that, so that if it's important to me that my children go to a particular school or continue with their religious education, to say that. And not so much that it becomes enforceable, but to give your guardians the understanding that this is important to you. One of my favorite lines in that is to say, at some point, my children aren't going to want to go to their religious classes. They aren't going to want to participate in this. And I'm counting on you to make them, to require them just like I would to make sure they continue these things. Because I think guardians are looking at these kids and saying, look, you just lost your parents. I don't want to make you do things you don't want to do. And that's fine to a point, but you want to make sure that the things that are important to your family continue.
Wow, I didn't know you could do that.
How enforceable it is, yeah. Those are all good questions, but to give guidance to your guardian, absolutely.
You can do it, and if somebody takes exception to it, this is my job.
It absolutely should be in every will or, however you're doing your guardianship, you absolutely should have provisions in there that say, if they're with my sister, make sure they have relationships with aunts and uncles and cousins on both sides of the family. Visit other sides of the family, do all of these things, just like we would do if we were the one left or if both of us were alive.
I'm still recovering from that. That's really good advice, and I didn't know you could do that.
Another thing that often comes up is I'm going to name my sister as the guardian, but she does. This is the one I get a lot. She doesn't have any money. I said, well, the reason we're doing a trust is to give her the money to raise your children. But she also doesn't have any place to live. They can't come and live with her. She lives in a shoebox apartment in downtown Manhattan. So what do we do? Well, we can have provisions that deal with her coming into their home and living there and taking care of them there and have provisions for keeping the home or another property. There are also situations where, I've got three kids. If something happens to my sister, I'm adding two children to my house and my house can't hold two more children. How do we deal with that? How do we deal with, what I have to spend as a trustee that benefits these children, but it's also going to have some ancillary benefits to me or to my children? And how do you deal with those gray areas? Mm. And those are the reasons why a lot of people think, well, I can't name my guardian as my trustee, rather than thinking, well, let's give guidance on how to deal with these areas.
Very interesting. What else do you work with? Do you ever work with grandparents over looking the shoulders of the parents to help the grandchildren?
Sure.
How do you keep them out, or how do you include them in?
Well, I think when you have grandchildren, what you're usually looking at is, if something happens to my daughter, where does the money that would have gone to my daughter go? And there's often a very strong instinct to say, well, I don't want it going to my son-in-law, but I want it to take care of my kids, my grandkids, her children. And so in the grandparents' will or trust, we're often going to create a grandchildren's trust, which is very similar to the trust the parents are doing. And you sort of have to make these decisions about who the trustee will be there. So if something happens to the daughter, well, the son's going to be the guardian. The grandma and grandpa aren't picking who's in charge of the kids. They're just picking who's in charge of grandma and grandpa's money that goes to these kids. That may be the son-in-law, and it often is. Oftentimes, grandma and grandpa will say, look, I love my son-in-law. He's great. I don't want to leave him money, but I do want him to be in charge of the money I leave to my grandchildren. I think he should decide when they get it and how and those sorts of things. Sometimes, they're very unhappy with the son-in-law and want him nowhere near the money. And so we deal with that as well.
Very interesting.
Some other documents. You want to make sure your power of attorneys that you do deal with. Minor children's not as much of an issue because you have a legal obligation to support your minor children. So your power of attorney, your agent, can use your money to benefit your minor children. But they can't do things for your minor children that you're not obligated to do. So if your children, for example, become adults and now it's time to pay for college, your agent under a power of attorney doesn't have the power to use your money to educate your adult children because you're not legally obligated in most states to educate your adult children. So you want provisions that deal with those sorts of things. How do I help my adult children in a way that would be consistent with what I assume I'm going to do? So you want to think about that as well.
Okay. And how about the folks that you mentioned are sitting on the fence and won't won't make the decision to come in. How do you draw them in? I mean, you can't beat them over the head, but I mean, what comments do you make, say, in class, because you know one of them is in class, to strike a note, say, okay, time to get off the fence?
The note is really responsibility. As much as that sounds like you are hitting someone over the head, I think most parents feel it. I think most parents understand that they should have a will, that at the very least, they should have something saying who the guardian is and what they want to happen with their kids. And I think for a lot of those people, it's just reminding them. You went out and got life insurance. You have other things in place for your children. You've gotten them into schools and you've gotten them into camp and you do all these things for them. But you also have to answer the question, what happens to me? What happens to them if something happens to me? And I think most parents understand that this is something I need to do. And the very act of sitting in a seminar for an hour and a half or 3 hours and listening to me talk about it usually leads people to understand that this is something they need to do.
Do you ever get class members volunteer to say, I was put into that position and this is what happened?
Sure. I think that a lot of the best examples are people saying, you know, my brother didn't plan. And now instead of having a trust where I'm the trustee and I can access the money, the court is in charge of the money. And every time I want to go and use the money for the kids, I've got to go to court and I have to ask the court's permission to do this thing or that thing above and beyond the sort of everyday things. And that's what happens if you don't deal with those things. And the other thing, dealing with your beneficiary designations, making sure the money is going to go into the places that your trustee can control.
Okay. Contact points again. We got about 30 seconds.
Mark, M-A-R-C, at handlerlevine.com, H-A-N-D-L-E-R-L-E-V-I-N-E. And the phone number is 301-961-6464, extension 3313.
Thank you, Mark. Great as always.
Thanks, Bob.
John, good to see you. Great as always.
Thank
Andrew,
you.
Andrew, thanks for bringing it down to a slow landing. And tune in next week for the Roth TSP 101, the really basic, because the week after, it's really going to be heavy. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.